Good morning, Barbados. Welcome to Brass Tack Sunday for May 27th. I'm Sanka Price, your moderator for today's programming, in which we'll try and analyze why the Barbados Labour Party was so overwhelmingly elected to office. And now they've been handed this unprecedented mandate by winning all the seats. How will this impact our democracy? To help us get this done today, we have in studio regional pollster and, of course, our fellow moderator, Mr. Peter Wickham. And on the line, we should be hearing Mr. Ezra Aline. He's an attorney, a longstanding attorney, lecturer, a longstanding lecturer as well at the University of West Indies Faculty of Law, and a specialist in constitutional matters. But before we get started, I need to remind you that this program is brought to you with the kind compliments of Williams Industries Incorporated.
You do not have to be a roofing expert to know that a metal sheet will rust where it is joined. That is one reason why the beautiful permaclad U-panel and R-panel roof sheet sold at Williams Metals will outlast other roofing materials. Permaclad, colorclad, and corrugated sheets are cut to the exact length that you will need, up to 40 feet and even longer. That means no joins from ridge to eave. Colorclad sheets come with a factory-painted finish in white, blue, green, red, brown, and yellow, and are fitted with screws for added resistance, tested to withstand high winds up to 130 miles an hour. Get a rail roof supplied at competitive prices. Delivered to you today from Williams Metals. Simply call Williams at Cane Garden St. Thomas 425-2000 or Lowlands Christ Church 428-1500.
Visit their website at www.williamsmetals.bb.
Welcome back to Brass Tacks. This is Sanka Price with you, your host today. Our producer is Mr. Ronald Clark. And in studio with me is Mr. Peter Wickham. Of course, you can participate in today's program by calling us at 4341790 or via WhatsApp at 266-4862. Peter, Thursday, or I should say Friday morning's victory. I get the distinct impression that Barbadians voted to punish the Democratic Labour Party as against voting for the Barbados Labour Party. I think they only voted for the Barbados Labour Party because that was the credible political organization around. Mm-hmm. But my impression is, given the wide margins that we saw, that they just wanted to punish the Democratic Labour Party. That is my impression. Yeah. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, thanks for the invite, Sanka. And no, I mean, the challenge I have with this election is that there are so many combinations and permutations that I want to discuss that I really do feel a bit overwhelmed. And I think that from a perspective of writing about it, there are so many angles that you want to explore. Generally speaking, when you have a landslide, there's a combination of push and pull factors. Landslides are invariably always associated with a bad government. But I do feel that the other side of it has to be a reasonably good alternative. And certainly in a situation where the alternative is outstanding, I think that this is the kind of result that you have. So my feeling is that a landslide could have been a result of a bad government. But I think that what we had, which was essentially a DLP bloodbath, was a result of not only a bad government, but a pretty good alternative, which is consistent with what I have been seeing all along. I mean, when I looked at polls before, I mean, and we can talk about this now, one of the consistent things that we had seen in polls leading up to the election, when we measured Mia Motley's popularity versus Frondell Stewart, he struggled to get out of single digits. I mean, in many of the constituencies that we polled, the preference for him as leader was in 7 or 8%. And the preference for Mia Motley as leader, the lowest was probably like 56, 57%. And that says to me that, yeah, people voted against the DLP in large numbers, but a lot of them also voted overwhelmingly for the Barbados Labour Party and the leadership of Mia Motley. And I think it was a combination of factors that led us to this place.
It raises a question. Just me slipping here, sure. Sorry, mm-hmm. to across you. But, and maybe we develop this in our conversation further down, but it also raises the question of who on the Democratic Labour Party side was at least getting into double digits in terms of popularity. Yeah. I don't know if you want to just...
Yeah, no, I mean, Don Valinis was the person that appeared most frequently on the DLP side as the preferred alternative. Chris Sinclair's name hardly ever showed up, but, you know, it is no
surprise.
Which
is consistent, therefore, with the argument that Chris Sinclair and Frondell Stewart yeah. were seen as
one and the same.
One of the same, and the persons who really inflicted the pain on Barbadians.
I mean, the part of the Chris Sinclair phenomenon that fascinates me is that I remember in 2010 when David Thompson died, Chris Sinclair was the person that emerged in polls as the most preferred to succeed him.
Yeah.
And I think that that is, Chris came from a way, way up to fall to the point where his name was hardly even mentioned in leadership stakes. Don Valinis, on the other hand, was someone who grew, and his growth was relatively steady. So I would say that of the ones available, Don Valinis would be the person that I would feel has the most resonance. And it's consistent with what we said 2 weeks ago when he was here with us in the studio, that I think that if the Democratic Labour Party had been led by Don Valinis, the situation would have been very different. I mean, they perhaps may have saved a seat or two. I don't know if they could have saved the government, but I feel they could have saved a seat or two if they had made the what was the logical choice at the time. Having said that, however, you know, they did what they did, and they suffered the consequences accordingly. But I am now at a place where, Sanka, quite frankly, I do not think that the Democratic Labour Party now can reasonably be led by any of those 30 people. My advice to the DLP is that they have to start root and branch reform. I agree entirely with Leroy McLean that George Pilgrim also needs to tender his resignation. Perhaps it is too soon to do it now because of the fact that he would destabilize the institution. But I think that in short order, the DLP needs to look for new leadership, new team. They need to start constituency selection processes to select the best candidate at the constituency level. Finish with this nonsense about the general counsel and the executive choosing candidates. I think the candidates ought to benefit from a democratic process at the constituency level. And it needs to start rebuilding. Because frankly, I don't think Don Valinis, and I've said this to him personally, or any of the others who face the polls, have two basic problems. One is that they were all rejected, and the second point is that they were part of what was easily the worst government that Barbados has ever had. And one has to question their judgment, which is a point that I also made to several of them. Why would you, at this point in time, knowing all that you know, want to associate yourself with this train wreck of a government that was obvious to everyone but those who were supporting it? You know, one of the incoming candidates called me and asked me what he thought, and I said to him, if you're interested in politics in the DLP, my advice to you is to wait out this election and go next time. Because I don't believe that you need the baggage of it. If you look at what young DePisa did in relation to the St. Michael North seat by sitting it out, I don't think that he's finished with politics, but I think that he took a wise decision to say, look, this is not the time. And to me, people like him are better placed to take back roles in the Democratic Labour Party now than someone like Kim Tudor, who came from a relatively successful and secure place in the private sector, or well, quasi-private sector, to throw herself in a political contest, which was not the contest that you want to fight. And I think that the judgment of all of them is serious in question. And my feeling is that the leadership of the Democratic Labour Party now perhaps has to come from somewhere else. But I mean, I think that what the Prime Minister has done is noble in giving them the opportunity to choose two people. And let's see how that choice goes, whether that choice will be guided by, you know, one of these unsuccessful 30, or whether it will be guided by a wisdom that says, let's see if we can start building a new ethos in the DLP.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that most people are asking, but there are two things. And
which is a good
idea. The first one is, how does we go forward in terms of governing this country if there's no
opposition
mm-hmm. in within mm-hmm. the lower house?
Mm-hmm.
You've had experience in working in Grenada, where Keith Mitchell did it twice,
yeah.
Three times.
Thrice.
Not once, twice, but thrice.
Thrice. Yeah.
How does that work?
Yeah, in middle
just
class.
Just sort of walk Barbadians through what you would have seen and how it has worked and how it managed to emerge.
Right. I mean, the first thing that you have to deal with is a perception. And I'm anxious to hear Ezra's take on this because he naturally knows more about constitutional matters than I do. So he will, I'm sure he will come on shortly and he can even respond and reject what I'm saying. But I think first thing we have to deal with is a perception. There is a misperception in Barbados that oppositions have power and that oppositions are relevant. And I made the point all the time that we have just been through the worst period of governance with the strongest opposition that we have ever had in our history. And I think that more than anything else demonstrates the extent to which oppositions are highly overrated or opposition numbers are highly overrated. what me and Motley was able to achieve in terms of bringing people out on the streets and whatnot, she could easily have done with the benefit of social media. And I don't know that the idea of having numbers in Parliament is as critical as people think. The other point is that, you know, the way our system is, does anybody realize that Ralph Gonzalez has a majority of one? Does anybody realize that Keith Mitchell had a majority of one for 5 years in Grenada, and he functioned quite effectively with it? In St. Kitts and Nevis, Timothy Harris has a majority of one, and his predecessor before, Denzel Douglas, also had a majority of one, right? Prime Minister Stewart had a majority of one, and all of these prime ministers had exactly the same power that Mia Motley has today with a majority of 30. So this perception that you make the prime minister more powerful when you don't have a parliamentary watchdog is something that I challenge, because I think that while the perception exists in terms of people's minds, you know, Grenada has proven over and over again, three times it has proven that it is not as big a deal, because when you make the mistake and do it once in 1999 in Grenada, that's fine. But Grenadians went back and did it again in 2013, and then they did it again in 2018, suggesting that the 2013 reality didn't spook them as much as we thought. And then they realized that, you know, as Grenadians would tell me, we had it three times in the body and dead. There are some institutional absences. For example, there's no leader of the opposition, which means that there's no one to consult with when judges are being appointed. There's no one to nominate people to the Senate, and there's no one to nominate anyone to the Electoral and Boundaries Commission. I think that the constitutional amendment will deal with all three of those matters and will make it possible for the Governor General, who does make those appointments, to be advised by another party. If the former opposition, the smaller of the two parties, is prepared to make nominations, former prime minister, then the nominations can be made. If not, then the prime minister can find someone who, as she said, reflects public opinion, you know, dissenting voices and so on, and she can put them in the Senate. My nod will go to Natalie as the alternative. If the Democrat and Labour Party decide not to take up the two seats, that they will have to give her one of the two. So that, to me, is relatively easily fixed. The Public Accounts Committee naturally would receive a report from the chief auditor for government. I remember the title eludes me now. But that is a specific role which Mia Motley performed as chairman of Public Accounts Committee, which cannot now be performed because there's no leader of the opposition. But I would like to think that for the time being, the Public Accounts Committee would not want to receive a report from the Auditor General in this era, because you essentially would be receiving a bad report on yourself. And what we have often found is that public accounts committees tend not to come alive in the first term. They come alive in the second term, because that's when you're receiving information on your opponent, but certainly to receive information on yourself. Public accounts committees tend not to function in the OECS because of the smallness. I don't believe that St. Kitts has ever had a meeting of theirs. Certainly St. Lucia, I think they may have met off and on. I don't know if it's alive and well in Grenada. It's not an institution that a lot of those countries know. We've known it, but the only time I recall ever seeing a comprehensive report from the PAC was last time under Mia Motley. And one would also recall that she released it via social media because she was blocked from releasing it in Parliament. So my article in today's Sun speaks to a lot of those issues. And I think in summary, I would just say that it is not that big a deal, quite frankly. It reflects the desire of the people not to have any of those individuals in Parliament. And I think that what you will see is that they will respect that view to that extent, embrace them where you can in the Senate, but certainly in the lower house, you know, the business will be conducted and life will go on. And I don't think that we are any more in peril today than we were yesterday. And my only hope is that by the end of the first five-year term, people will understand the extent to which an opposition doesn't really make that big a difference in this winner-take-all Westminster system that we have.
All right, Ezra.
Sorry, it was so long.
We have Ezra Aline on the line. Ezra, are you?
Hi.
Hi. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you and to all of that.
Good morning, Ezra. Morning,
Hi, Peter.
I was asking Peter about, I don't know if you heard.
I heard most of it, thank you.
Good, great.
The more important point is whether you agree.
Or disagree.
That has been elusive in the past.
Your views, Ezra.
I have a fairly straightforward view on this business of the result of the poll, because I hold the view that a general election is a referendum on the government of the day. To that extent, the Barbados Labour Party properly and vigorously prosecuted the record of the Democratic Labour Party. And not only that, they put forward their own proposals for how they are prepared to govern in a manner consistent with the best interests of the country. Now, I think that the verdict of the people sends a message to all political parties. The public is prepared to get involved in their business, which is the business of the country being run properly. And if they feel sufficiently strongly, they will deliver their verdict in terms of the way they wield the power of the X. This election result is a message to all parties that the people are the masters and the politicians are the servants, and that if your report card fails, then you will see the power of the people being exercised. Now, I think that the result also gives an opportunity for a greater participation of what I call the civil aspects of the public, you know, community groups and so on, to comment on measures which the government proposes to take. Because we have to build a participatory democracy. The fact that there is no physical opposition may be a constitutional oddity here. But the point is that whether there's an opposition or not, it is always vital for the public to have an ongoing interested say in what is happening in their name. And to that extent, I think that the way the Constitution will be permitted to function, if the public truly understands the power that they have, is that they will keep the government on its toes, and the government will speak to the people as necessary and carry the people with them in the strong measures that will have to be taken to repair the damaged ship of state. That's my position at this point.
But generally, though, Ezra, if I may, Sankar.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Are there any specific concerns that you have regarding the appointment of judges, the appointment of a representative to the EBC, regarding the appointment of senators? Did I leave out anything else? I think those are the key functions.
Police Service Commission.
Police Service Commission.
Yeah, obviously these things matter. Mm-hmm. But in the situation which has arisen, the government has a responsibility as government to think through the implications of the result and to tweak the constitution, and by that I mean the broad constitution, the constitution of the state, tweak all of the aspects of the state in order to compensate for the absence of the official opposition in the lower house, which is where the real battle takes place. And I am extraordinarily pleased that the Prime Minister has already given the public the indication that she is thinking in a manner consistent with the duty that every Prime Minister has to run the country in such a way that opinion contrary to the government's opinion is not shut out. One has to invite contrary opinion, one has to consider it, and then one has to make the decision consistent with considering all aspects of the matter. I think that is critically important at this stage if this country is to move forward in a manner consistent with a young participatory democracy.
And then what about the situation now? Let's move on. We have a new cabinet.
Yeah.
Huge cabinet.
Yeah.
26 members it is.
Yeah. I have no problem with the cabinet. My position is very clear on this.
Well, already on the social media, the criticism has started that it's a lot of money. Yeah. Don't forget, bear in the air.
Yeah, I know, but bear with me for a second. Uh-huh. I am what I call a political and constitutional realist. If your prime minister cannot manage politics on the domestic front, then I don't see how she's going to be able to manage them on the regional or international front. What has happened so far is a good example of managing the politics of the result and the local situation. Mm. I leave that to Peter now to expand on what I think.
No, I always
the situation,
see, for Ezra, for so many years you and I have been on opposite sides of these issues.
Right.
So I look forward to, instead of having my views destroyed by you, to have them supported.
Oh dear.
No, because I've explained it to people that look, 26, this, a cabinet of 26 is a lot, especially in the context of economic uncertainty and the fact that we have, we've been complaining for a long time about cabinet sizes getting too big. I like the Cayman Islands model that limits the size of the cabinet at X. Can't remember the number. But certainly, if you limited at 20 to me, constitutionally, I would think that is a good step. Having said that, however, 30 seats present a political reality that Mia Motley has to manage. And I'm saying we can jump up and down about the size of the cabinet and the cause, or we can just speak to the fact that if she does not take certain steps politically, she will be gone as quickly as she came. And the whole idea of all of the plans and the proposals and buying the 20 buses and the 6 garbage trucks and all of these things that you plan to do will come to nothing if the government is not able to survive. And it's a question of political survival. And you have some mature politicians, and I call them mature politicians out of deference to yourself, Ezra, who is also a mature politician, who have been around parliament for a long time and who are likely to make this their last term.
Yeah.
How can you have persons like that on your backbench languishing in a situation where all they have to do is walk across the island, they become leader of the opposition, which makes a tremendous difference to them financially.
Right.
And it also makes little difference to them politically, because in the final analysis, they're not planning to face another election.
Right.
And you have about 5 of these people who are in a similar situation where this is likely to be their last term. You cannot allow those people to sit on the backbench. And while this may have been the plan before, where you had a backbench large enough, an opposition large enough, that you would have to have a union between 2 or 3 in order to do it, you really only can put people on the backbench now who you are absolutely certain will not make a move to move towards the opposition. And I think that the people who have been left on the backbench are people who are new to parliament, who would want to have a career in politics beyond this term, and who don't see crossing the floor and becoming leader of the opposition as something too exciting to avoid.
Well, actually, one of the questions being asked here on our WhatsApp is, what about Bishop Joseph Atherley, Ralph Thorne, and Ian Gooden-Edgell?
Right.
Because those are the three that really don't have, quote-unquote, a job in the government or parliament.
Apart
from the MPs, yes.
Sorry, without indicating that I have somehow examined Mia Motley's brain and knows what she's thinking, it is clear to me that there are certain political realities attendant upon the 30 love victory.
Mm-hmm.
And my considered and hard-nosed view is that she has so far managed those political realities extraordinarily well. I'm not worried so much about the 3 left on the backbench, because as far as I'm concerned, a good leader will have consulted with all of her team, and she will know what she has said to the to all the members of the team and what they have said to her. And as I said before, if you can't properly manage the domestic realities of local politics, then I do not see you managing the realities of regional and international politics. There has to be give and take. There has to be a certain pragmatism. I am pleased with what I've seen so far.
But you look at those two, though, Sanka, 2 of the 3. Reverend Atherley represents a special case. But you look at 2 of the 3, and you have 2 professionals who are doing exceedingly well in their own individual professional career.
Mm-hmm.
And who are young to politics. And I imagine that, you know, there will be a role in later years for both of those individuals. But, you know, they're not doing badly on their own, no. I mean, certainly Ralph Thorne's regional practice is enviable. I think that Ezra would envy it himself, being an attorney at law.
Not at all. I am. But
you're academic, though, that's right.
Yeah, but let me say this.
Yeah.
Ralph used to be my student at KFL. I have always regarded him as one of the sharpest tools in the box when it comes to legal analysis and so on.
Right.
So that he is there to serve.
Yeah.
And I don't think he's hankering necessarily after office. I've spoken to him on many occasions before the election.
I agree. Mm-hmm.
So I don't have problems with those.
So that's it. Yeah.
All right, but gentlemen, let's take a call. you're on Brass Tacks. Good morning. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning. You're on the air. Yes. Good morning. You're on Brass Tacks.
Sorry.
She can't. I don't know what happened there. Anyway, gentlemen, I also
I just want to make a very quick point, though, okay. In relation to the same thing of the cabinet selection. Mm-hmm. Mia Motley is in the honeymoon period now. I think that there's still a euphoria and a glow from last week, Thursday, that allows her to do something like this. If she takes front and does this up front in terms of the large cabinet, and this is the last major controversial thing that she does, my thing is that she recovers easily, because any moves that she makes now that are controversial, she can recover from relatively quickly. As time goes, it's going to be harder to do that. So I think another important thing about this point is that the new cabinet is a controversial thing. It's done up front, and I think that politically, the effect of it by this time next week will probably be null.
Yeah. What I want to do is to read a couple of WhatsApp messages, because, you know, we get consistently get complaints that we're not reading enough of these messages. Good morning, moderator. I would really love to hear that voice of Straker's tenantry with all of the rhetoric displayed by him in connection with Peter Wickham and polls. I am convinced that the phobia of the people as to where they were being led came to light after we would have read where our reserve stands. This is international reserve stand and the situation of our currency. They came with the old lady on the bus. Then they used the bus again for the army. However, on social media some time ago, we saw a bus traveling the road with a huge hole where you could have seen the road. Just wondering if it's the same bus the army used. And this one is saying, my views on the elections, the previous administration overinflated their sense of power and grossly underestimated the intelligence of the Barbadian public. And this next one, let's talk about the absence of polls this election. And will you guys mention the horrible IMF report? And sir, I will certainly come to that one. But let's talk about the absence of polls this election.
No, I mean, I heard Bobby Morris commenting both on national television and also on a program he did with me in Jamaica about the absence of polls. And he suggested that it was a conspiracy to hold the poll data. I think that it speaks to the extent to which the Democratic Labour Party's team was completely at sea regarding political strategy, because the first thing that they should have done is commissioned a poll. Mm-hmm. And I would have thought that, you know, like most candidates, they will come to me and say, you know, I'm thinking of running, I want to commission a poll. So you get an idea of what you're facing. He admitted that they did no such thing. So they were surprised by the outcome. I wasn't surprised. So, I mean, just bear in mind that polls don't have to be done by a nation newspaper. Polls can be done by any individual, and they can be commissioned, and, you know, they can be presented. I somehow think, though, after this result, and as we compare it to the previous year's result, I would be very hard-pressed to see whether we're going to have election polls being published in the paper in the near future, because my sense is that had the polls been published, and I must tell you that the polls said exactly what was likely to happen was happening, I'm sure that that would not have happened, because there are many people who I've spoken to subsequently that said to me, had I known this was what was going to happen, I would have voted for the Democratic Labour Party, mm-hmm. because I have concerns about the fact that there's no opposition. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think that a political organization that sets out to win would want to shoot itself in the foot. And, you know, the other point is that the Democratic Labour Party itself didn't help the situation, because the DLP did all it could to discredit me as an individual in the press. In the lead up to the poll, they spoke about it on the platform and they said that it's showing this and it's showing that, when the reality of it is that the best thing for them would have been a publication of a poll the Sunday before the election, because I'm sure today they would have been able to save a seat, because Barbadians would have been so concerned. Mm-hmm. So having said that, I honestly don't know that there's going to be an anxiety to have polls published before elections again after this, because I feel that what people will do is they will do the assessments as time go on. But I am inclined to think that, you know, the months before an election or so on, that they will leave it alone, which is the case in France. Huh? You can't mm-hmm. publish a public opinion poll a month mm-hmm. before election. Right. I have always been one that said, I don't think they make a difference. I am persuaded after what happened in 2013 and what happened now, that this is the reality. And I must tell you that I polled in Grenada and in Antigua, where similar things were likely to happen. And in both instances, the polls were also withheld and not published, because the concern was that, you know, that type of information doesn't really help people vote the way that their heart tells them. They vote with their head and not their heart.
We take some phone calls. You are on the air. Good morning, Ezra. You're still with us, correct?
I'm still here. Yeah, you're
good. All right. But we have a couple of other phone calls, so let's take a phone call here. You're on the air. Good morning. Brass Tack Sunday.
Hello?
Yes, go right ahead with your question, sir. You're on the air.
Not really a question. I want to put two facts here to y'all. Y'all asking why you believe the BLP won. You see, some time ago, Mr. Wickham said that about 50% of Belgians use drugs.
I don't know 30, if that was 30 a poll. Something.
I don't know if that was a poll or his opinion.
It was 30-something percent. It was a poll.
Okay. Well, yeah. Well, I agree with you, but you see, those are people who openly use it. But there's another 15 or 20% who discreetly use it. Mm-hmm. So I believe those are some of the people that have voted against the government, because you don't forget the BLP said they're thinking about legalizing it.
Mm-hmm.
Also, with this foolishness about same-sex marriage, mm-hmm. you know that there's a group of people, about 15 or another 20%, who would go along with that idea. So right off the hand, see, the bad people that had about 50 to 60% of the population in their favor to vote. I don't know what you're saying.